I have a message from another time. Aerie Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, No. 2, Third Movement, Another Christmas Rose, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Janice Barlow, Megazone, Pearson Moy, and Chris Overstreet. Contains Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. Saturday, December 24th, 2405, Highway 72, Titan, Solar System. Caitlin Hutchins was slightly disappointed as she drove her old Impala down Highway 72, southward out of the port city of Beltane. She supposed it was nice and Christmassy enough for there to be snow falling, but there was already plenty of it on the ground, giving the piney forest surrounding Beltane a festive air as it flickered past the speeding black car and the rest of the convoy it led. Kate felt a little self-conscious about that last part, but mostly she was disappointed that it was overcast. They were quite an interesting little caravan, following in train behind Vlad the Impala. Corwin's black Griffin limousine, Moose McEachern's converted school bus, Kyuichi Sionji, insane, out of his freaking mind, bundled up like a polar explorer on his old sidecar motorcycle, Kate's father, in heated power suit, no fool he, on his old navy blue Garland, all beamed into the WDF cargo handling facility in Beltane from the holds of the IPO starship Challenger for the occasion. They got off at the exit for Route 11, a much less impressive thoroughfare, then rolled up into the mountains to the southeast of Beltane, leaving any trace of civilization, aside from the road, behind. In the Impala's passenger seat, Juri Arisugawa sat with her chin propped on the knuckles of her right hand, looking thoughtfully out the window at the snowy trees. Quietly she murmured, "Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow." Caitlin glanced across the car at the redhead, smiled, and said, "My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year." Wakaba Shinohara suddenly appeared, leaning over the back of the seat between the two, her elbows touching their shoulders, and chimed in, "He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake." Then all five of the car's occupants, four girls and Miki Kaworu, said together, "The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." "And they say," said Dorothy Wainwright dryly into the companionable silence that followed, "that students always forget everything as soon as final examinations are complete." Behind them, Corwin Ravenhair squinted through the falling snow and the small rear window of the convertible ahead, and wondered what all the laughing was about. Not long after, they came around that last long, sweeping right-hand turn. Utena Tenjo, gauging it from the passenger seat of Corwin's Griffin, thought it looked like it would be a lot of fun to take, on dry pavement, at about 85, and arrived at a set of wrought-iron gates and a high stone wall. The gates were standing open, and above them an iron arch carried the words, "Castle Eyrie." Below that, in smaller letters, whose more elaborate font made them harder to read, it added, "Beware! Cranberry Bogs!" "Cranberry Bogs?" asked Azalin Devir Natashkin from one of the seats of Moose's van. "Caitlin's parents have very peculiar senses of humor," Liza Shustal informed her airily. "Oh my," she added, as the structure whose name the gate had announced appeared out of the pines, the road rising up to meet it. It was, as the name implied, a castle, but a very different sort than the castle on Gerardo, where the Diedlitz Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute Duelist Society and some of their best friends lived. Where the duelist's castle was made of smooth, reddish and gold stone, with four flat-top towers and a large golden dome in the center of the roof, a vaguely Moorish style if it had to be compared to something earthly. This looked more like an old-fashioned Welsh castle, all in gray stone blocks with many mullioned arch windows, crenellations all along the roofline, and four-corner turrets like chess rooks. It loomed stark against the white sky, flags flying from poles on its turret roofs, perched on the pinnacle of the hill, up which the road ran from the forest below. They passed through the outer curtain wall, and found within it a thing that no Welsh castle ever had, a parking lot, one that already had a number of cars and small spacecraft in it. The duelists and company had driven over from Beltane because Kate insisted on it, saying you couldn't properly appreciate Castlereagh's location without coming to it overland for the first time. Apparently some of those who had already arrived had been here before, since it seemed obvious that a few had flown in directly from orbit. They parked, disembarked, and went inside, not quite knowing what to expect. Castlereagh looked rather forbidding from the outside, unlike the warm, welcoming colors and texture of the duelist's castle. Would the inside also be chilly and gray? They'd heard that Kate's father hadn't used the place in a while. Many were envisioning scenes like the old, dilapidated castles they'd seen in history vids, with molding tapestries and cobwebbed suits of armor. It was not without some trepidation that they stepped through the man door set into one of the huge main portals, and into the castle's entrance door behind its beaming owner. What they found was clean, bright, and warm, lit by the friendly yellowish glow of hollow lamps set to mimic bright fire, and a respectable number of actual candles. There were hardwood floors and nice rugs over them, clean, unmoldering tapestries and paintings on the walls, and a nice, wintry smell, a subtle and hard-to-define combination of wood smoke, the freshness of winter air, and hot cocoa. Rug-covered stairs led up in the center, then branched off to both sides. Beyond them on the ground floor, twin archways led to what looked like a ballroom. There were doors off to the sides here and there, and many more off the landings upstairs. On the wall above the central landing was a banner emblazoned with the scarlet star of the IPO. Their host, Captain Benjamin Hutchins, better known as Griffin, stopped at the base of the stairs, turned around and faced them, grinning. "Not quite what you were expecting, is it?" he asked. The duelist and company admitted, a bit sheepishly, that it was not. The answer actually seemed to delight their host even more. He giggled, rubbing his hands together. "I'm actually relieved that the place is so clean," he admitted. "I haven't used the place in several years. Been too busy setting up the IPO and whatnot. And although there's a sizable maintenance drone contingent, I'm never sure about these things until I check them out for myself. Anyway, let me show you to your rooms, so you can get freshened up from the trip. Dinner's at 6. The man was obviously enjoying playing host. Those in the group who hadn't met him before, or had only met him a couple of times, and so knew him better by his public reputation, defender of justice, immortal warrior, etc., were somewhat taken aback by the almost childlike glee he was taking in showing off his summer house. He took them up the stairs, through one of the doors in the back, and up another flight of stairs, eventually bringing them to a long corridor with doors off to both sides. "Now," he said, "I wasn't sure how you'd want your rooming arrangement set up, but there are plenty of rooms in this wing, and the drones tell me they're all ready for occupation, so I figured the best thing to do is let you figure it out amongst yourselves. Just don't make any kind of mess you're not willing to clean up yourselves, and try to keep the noise down. Okay?" A number of pairs of eyes blinked back at Griffin in varying levels of astonishment, which made him grin a little wider. "Hey," he said, "I know better than to try and micromanage. You're all smart kids. You all know how to play it safe." He winked. Erd will have seen to that. Even though she had no intention whatsoever of getting up to any kind of mischief over the holidays, Utrina Tencho felt her face burning with a furious blush as she went to stake out one of the corner rooms. With parents like that guy and Skuld, he reflected, how could Corwin have come out any way other than brutally honest? Caitlin grinned at her as the two put their suitcases on the room's king-size bed and started unpacking. "Why this surprised look?" she asked. "You knew my dad was cool." "Yeah," Utrina replied, stowing her pajamas in the top drawer of the room's big oak dresser. "But I didn't think he was that cool." Kate shrugged. "He knows if he tried to police us, we'd just be sneaking around. All he'd accomplish would be to turn it into work and kill the fun. He hates to kill people's fun. Anyway, he trusts us." "If he's trusting Liza and Azalin, he's in for a rude shock," said Utrina wryly. Kate smiled. "He's trusting them not to hurt anybody. Other than that, he's not picky. Utrina shook her head. "Quite an approach. Part of my surprise look is because you're here, though," she went on. "Special occasion and all that. I mean, your dad just gave you a license to steal," she added with a grin. Kate smiled again, but shook her head. "Not yet," she said. "Maybe soon, but not yet." She looked up from her now empty suitcase. "Unless I'm inconveniencing you?" Utrina kept grinning, vaulted the bed like it was the hood of a car, and put her arm around Kate's shoulders. "Yeah," she said dryly, "like I've got big plans for this weekend. Come on, give me a tour. This place is amazing." "I wish it wasn't overcast," Kate said ruefully as she followed her roommate's instructions and led her out into the hallway. "Then you'd really see amazing." With such a large group of guests, the gentleman and lady of the house didn't have a lot of time to spend one-on-one with anyone present, but the kids found agreeable ways to pass the time. That afternoon, the duelists wandered the castle, alone and in groups, exploring its passageways and towers. The grounds out front, from the curtained wall down to the edge of the road, made for an excellent sledding ground, though one had to be careful to wipe out where the ground flattened so as not to go speeding into the precinct wall. Caitlin's brother Leonard, always an enthusiastic proponent of sledding, put together a sizable group which spent the afternoon pursuing this very activity. Liza Schustal found herself up at the top of the East Tower, wrapped up in her gray traveling cloak, looking out over the Tsiolkovsky Sea. On this snowy day, the wind was raising whitecaps on the choppy surf far, far below, the castle's height plus that of the cliff it stood on, so far down that the pier jutting out from the beach at the cliff's base looked like a model from up here. The overcast stretched away into infinity, light gray blending into dark where sky met sea. It ought to have been a rather oppressive view, all in shades of gray, but to Liza it wasn't. She found the wind bracing, and the faint scent of the sea which reached her way up here added a certain extra something. So did the knowledge of where she was. Never, in her wildest imaginings, which were admittedly not that wild before June, had she ever thought she would be here, at one of the most privately held of the Hutchins family's domains. For Titan, the entire moon, belonged to Caitlin's father. He had purchased it from a real estate holding consortium in the chaos following the war of corporate occupation, and by the time Earth had a government worthy of the name again, they had nothing to say about it. It was all perfectly legal. The moon's 100,000 or so inhabitants paid a nominal rent and had well-secured leases. The owner was quite benevolent, as feudal overlords went, and by and large things ran quite smoothly in his absence. All of which meant that Ephraim Broadbank, sworn foe of Kate's father and all he stood for, could never expect to step foot on the place, much less send one of his children there. Liza had heard of it, of course. It was held repeatedly up to her during her childhood as one of the best examples of the wretched excesses to which the immortal frauds were given. She'd never expected to see it, though, and now here she was, by express invitation of Caitlin. "All my friends will be there," she said, and smiled. "All my friends." Liza raised her left hand from within the folds of her cloak and looked at her wristwatch for a moment. It was an expensive one, a Philippe Jardin, studded with gems, extremely gaudy. There had been a time when it was her most prized possession. Its overdone, conspicuous costliness was a badge of honor under her old value system. Her father had given it to her 10 years ago, in appreciation for services rendered. She unbuckled it, turned it over, and read the laser-etched inscription on the back, though she knew it by heart. "For my darling Elizabeth, well done. ECB, 03-17-95. Well done. The highest accolade Ephraim Broadbank could convey, the most shining praise his soul contained. Liza snorted bitterly at the memory, then reared back abruptly and hurled the watch out in a glittering arc away from the castle and the cliff. She lost sight of it long before it plopped into the sea. "Liza?" came a voice from behind her. "Are you okay?" Liza turned, smiling, to see Azalin Dvir-Natashkin emerging from the hatchway leading down into the east tower. The Dantrovian, bundled up against the cold in a green cloak not too unlike Liza's, slogged through the snow to the blonde's side, looking curious and concerned. "Everything's fine, Azalin," Liza told her. "I was just thinking about old times." "What was that you just threw?" asked Azalin. So Liza told her. Sunday, March 17th, 2395, Caitlin's 6th birthday. She'd invited Liza Broadbank to her party, hoping that extending the hand of friendship to her most determined enemy could end the misunderstanding and make a friend. And if it had been a misunderstanding, it might have worked. But of course it wasn't. And Liza, 5-year-old Liza, cunning and cruel, had exploited her opponent's naive goodwill and sent Caitlin, in tears, fleeing to her room. It had only taken a few well-chosen remarks, made quietly enough that no misbehavior could ever be pinned on Liza, and the party had, of course, been ruined. Liza had come home covered in glory, the first major success of the campaign, her father had called it, and the Jardin had been her reward. It had never been any kind of secret what she'd done to earn it, and from then on, Caitlin had never made the mistake of trying to find Liza's better nature again. Azalin, who had heard much of Ephraim Broadbank over the course of the last month, shook her head in disbelief. "Deville, what an awful man," she muttered, looking out at the choppy sea, "treating his own daughter like an employee." Liza nodded. "I don't take it personally," she replied philosophically. "Daddy treats everyone like an employee, even Mother, especially Mother. I can just see him, sitting at the breakfast table in 2392, looking at the society section in the Avalon Herald Bulletin. See here that Morgan woman's got herself another one in the oven. Guess that means we'll have to have another ourselves."
"If you say so, dear."
She shook her head. What a way to run a railroad.
"Did that really happen?"
Liza shrugged. "How should I know? I was 3 in 2392. But it's the kind of thing I could see him doing." She sighed. "Anyway, did you come up here with some sort of news, or were you just looking for me?" Azalin grinned. "They're done sledding," she said. "Kate's mom made hot chocolate. She wondered if you'd want any."
"Is Mary here yet?"
"No," Azalin replied, shaking her head. "They won't be here until tomorrow after breakfast. They're doing Christmas morning on Tomodachi before Aunt Belle brings them over." Liza nodded. Well, in that case, let's go have some cocoa.
You look cold,
she remarked as they made their way toward the hatch.
I am a little, Asselin replied. I've been outside most of the day.
Liza smiled. Well then, once we've had our cocoa, perhaps I'll have to warm you up.
Oh, I'd like that.
I thought you might. They were a convivial group, chatting and sipping cocoa in the castle's big library, a great fire going in the fieldstone fireplace that dominated one whole wall. Liza and Asselin were curled up together in one end of one of the couches, bundled under Liza's cloak, talking with Moose McEachern about Kate's plan to have her band, The Art of Noise, perform at tomorrow night's big Christmas party. If they thought the group that was here now, on Christmas Eve, was big, tomorrow night's was going to be positively gargantuan. Griffin had a habit of inviting everybody he and Kay could think of to the castle shindigs, and over 400 years of life a person can build up a lot of friends and acquaintances. For tonight, though, it was all a bit more intimate. There were little groups, pairs and trios mostly, of people scattered around the room, drinking cocoa, talking, reading, playing games. R. Dorothy Wainwright and Miki Kaworu were hunched over the marble chess set. Liza would have made even odds that they didn't realize they were holding hands along one side of the board while they moved their pieces with their free hands. Dorothy had to keep shooing Peril off the board. He seemed to have developed a fascination for bishops and kept trying to knock them over. Corwin and Utina were playing 8-ball. Presently, Caitlin started playing something light and festive on the piano. Moose excused himself, got up, and disappeared upstairs for a few moments. When he returned, he had his bass guitar with a plug amp rigged for practice. Kate noticed him entering, so equipped, and smiled. When she finished the little song she was playing, she nodded to him, and he leaned against the curve of the piano and began playing a pretty, faintly haunting melody with a deliberate walking pace. Kate played an accompanying line, sympathetic and nicely harmonic, which was probably intended to be played on another bass guitar. Their collaboration grew slowly more and more complex, as both started adding chords to what had been a simple overlapping solo. They grew it and layered it until it seemed that it couldn't go on without losing its calm, deliberate pace, and then, just as their now rapt audience felt it threatening to slip from their control, it ended, fading away in one last resonant harmony that left the room in silence. Then the room filled with applause, and the beaming Hoffmanite bowed to his accompanist, then to their audience. Miki Kaworu smiled at Dorothy and then returned his attention to the chessboard. His intention to resume his concentration on the board was thwarted again, though, as Moose and Kate weren't done. The impromptu bass and piano recital continued for almost half an hour, during which no progress was made on the chess game, but neither Miki nor Dorothy minded much. It was a rare opportunity to hear Moose McEachern in a classical mood. He was a hell of a rock bassist. As his bandmates, they got a chance to hear that pretty frequently. He let his classical side out to play less often, though, and Miki had come to enjoy very much the rare occasions when he got to hear Moose's version of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. He still had some hope that he could convince the Hoffmanite to play that one on stage for an audience someday. Moose and Kate were interrupted by the call to dinner, which proved as pleasant and cheerful an affair as the afternoon gathering by the fire had been, albeit with less of a soundtrack. After dinner, most of the duelists and friends retired to their rooms to make an early night of it, while the family and those closest to it, Utna, Dorothy, Miki, Juri, retired to the library to observe a family tradition and open one gift early. Sionji and Wakaba found themselves invited this time around as well. In Wakaba's case, that was understandable. She'd been Utrina's best friend back at Otori Academy and was still in the top three. In his own case, it struck Sionji as slightly surreal, given that only a couple of days before Christmas vacation started a year ago, he'd tried to kill Caitlin. This year, though, he was her student, and as such, he was deemed part of the family. He stood, a bit uncomfortably, by the smaller of the castle's two Christmas trees. The bigger one, in the ballroom, was immense, and watched as Kate's younger siblings ransacked the trove under that tree to make their one choice, then were packed off to bed one by one. Well, age band by age band. Sionji decided he didn't want to think very much about the glee in the eyes of Pris Morgan and Sylvie Daniels as they all but dragged Pris's poor twin brother Guy up the stairs. Like last year, and every year, books were a common theme. This was a very literate group of friends and relations. This year, Utna went into the progression between Corwin and Kate, having been accorded something above guest status. Hers turned out to be a beautifully painted new addition to her collection of rose-themed teacup sets, discovered by Kay Morgan at random while she was on an IPO mission to the far-flung former Japanese colony world, Ishiyama. When Caitlin's turn came, no one nudged her toward any particular package, as had been the case the year before, and the package she selected at random was almost certainly a book, a fairly large and heavy-looking one. She tore away the wrapping paper and examined the cover, then laughed and held it up so the others could see the bold black title emblazoned across the orange cover. Your Tiger and You, Sharing Space with the Greatest of Great Cats. A wave of laughter rounded the room. Everyone there was well acquainted with Kate's fondness, sometimes bordering on obsession, for the striped creatures. She had a huge collection of stuffed ones. Her pajamas were patterned after them. Her formal wear hinted at their colors. Kate went pink and smilingly thumbed through the book. Despite its tongue-in-cheek title, it seemed to be an actual handbook for keeping a tiger as a pet. She looked at her father, who was beaming with that special look he got when he just pulled off what he felt was a particularly clever gift. Some of Griffin's clever gifts had a tendency for their recipients to miss the point, but Caitlin caught this one all right. It was her father's half-joking way of acknowledging, or maybe reminding her of, her dream for future reference. Kate tucked the book under her arm, gave her father the "Okay, you win, good one," smile, and the gift-opening baton was passed to Dorothy, technically the eldest of the children involved. The one she chose turned out to be from Corwin, and it was some small, intricate piece of equipment whose function no one in the room could divine. Except, presumably, the recipient, who was delighted with it, and the giver, who was pleased at its reception. Dorothy tucked the device away in a pocket and only answered Miki Kaworu's querying look with an enigmatic little smile. From there, the honor passed to the guests, in ascending order of age, which meant that Miki was next. And what a surprise! A book on piano techniques. Well, what was I supposed to get him? Wakaba grumped later when Utena kidded her about it. The Kama Sutra? It'd probably bore him. Oh, now you're just exaggerating, Utrinna replied. Griffin was very pleased that Juri liked the bowling shoes he'd found for her. He never quite knew how to shop for people as elegant as the redhead, and he wanted to make a good impression, since she was apparently Kate's girlfriend or something now. They were the most damned elegant bowling shoes he'd ever seen, though. He'd been just amazed when he found them in the pro shop at the Crescent Heights Bowlodrome. Looked like the kind of thing rich socialites went dancing in, with a sure grip heel and a super glide sole. Just the thing. He hadn't wanted to cop out and go for the obvious thing and get her something fencing-related. That left Sionji, the old man of the group, at 19, and there wasn't really much sport in the package that awaited him. If it wasn't a Bokuto, it couldn't have been much of anything else, except possibly a rather deficient oar. On the other hand, it was a very nice Bokuto. Its grip carved into the semblance of a katana's braiding, its blade decorated with patterns that almost looked Celtic. He accepted it with humility and pride, taking it as the mark of the fact that, though an experienced swordsman, in the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu he was but a novice. With that taken care of, they cleared away the wrapping paper and scattered to their various activities again. Miki and Dorothy returned to their interrupted chess game. Kate curled up on one of the couches next to Juri and started reading her book. She wondered briefly at the curious grin that her father gave Jury when he walked by the couch on her way out of the library, but passed it off as his usual holiday expansiveness.
"It's good to see he's happy for you," Jury noted with her little Vulcan smile, as if to confirm Kate's suspicions.
Kate grinned, feeling her cheeks get warm, and replied, "Well, why wouldn't he be?"
"Why indeed?" asked Jury philosophically. Then she fell silent, letting Kate enjoy her book. That was one of the many things Kate liked about her. If anyone understood that friends didn't have to talk all the time, and recognized the value of a companionable silence, it was Jury Arisugawa.
Utnu was wandering through one of the castle's corridors pretty much at random, and thinking in pretty much the same fashion. It struck her as curious how much of her life seemed to involve, in some tangential fashion or another, castles. She lived in one on Gerardo. The little one up on Bancroft Hill had shaped several important events of her and her friends' lives in Worcester. Much of her life in her last year at Ottori Academy had revolved around one, and here she was, spending her second Christmas in this world at one. Except it occurred to her, none of them were real. The duelist's castle on Gerardo wasn't a castle at all, only looked like one. It had actually, according to Mia Aus's research, been some kind of ancient temple. The same went for Bancroft Tower, which was too small to be much of a tower, let alone a proper castle. This castle, medieval British though its style might be, was less than 20 years old, and had been raised in this spot on the whim of a man who was well known for his whimsy. It defended nothing, except perhaps its master's privacy on the rare occasions when he came here to use it. And as for the hanging castle of Sephiro, in their last confrontation Akio had claimed that it never existed, that it was just another one of his illusions. No dueling floor, no castle in the sky, nothing but that big room at the top of his godforsaken tower. But somehow Utna couldn't shake the suspicion that that was the lie, not the rest of it. There was something different about that last encounter, something she couldn't put her finger on, some extrasensory wrongness which set it apart from all the other times she'd taken the floor against an opponent with the castle's lights glowing above her. There was nothing concrete she could point to and say, "There, you see, he's lying." But the suspicion remained, and with it a frustrating compulsion to go and see, have it proven one way or the other. "Oh well," she thought, sighing. "Another thing to put on my to-do list when I get back, right after finding Anthy and gutting her brother." She decided she didn't want to think about him anymore, and was just in search of something else to divert her mind when Corwin Ravenhair came around the corner ahead of her, Nall perched on his shoulder, gleeful expressions on both their faces. They only brightened when they caught sight of her, and without warning, Corwin lunged forward, grabbed one of her hands, and started pulling her along the corridor, saying, "Oh, good, there you are. Come on, Kate and I..." "We," said Nall importantly, "we want you to see something. Where's your coat?"
"In my room. Why?"
"You'll want it," Corwin replied, his blue eyes twinkling. Utna allowed herself to be conducted to her room without demur, collected her black woolen overcoat, and then followed Corwin to one of the far corners of the castle, then up and up and up a spiral staircase, climbing one of the towers. She was under strict instructions not to look out the windows, and such was the look of gleeful anticipation on Corwin's face that she obeyed without complaint. She had a suspicion of what he wanted her to see anyway, and the anticipation was mounting with each step upward. Now, eyes closed, she was led out through a doorway into the cold outside air, her shoes scraping on bare stone, hand tucked in Corwin's elbow. There were voices up here, Caitlin's soft, slightly husky murmur, talking in a hushed, unintelligible tone to Jury, whose low tone in response was pitched almost like a purr. Utna smiled slightly as she was led closer to the voices, and they broke off their conversation to greet her and Corwin.
"Can I look yet?"
she asked Corwin with good-natured wryness.
Not yet, Nall replied.
Then she felt Corwin's warm hands on her shoulders as he carefully aimed her in the right direction.
There we are. Now then, I'd like you to meet a friend of mine. Utnatenjo?
He tapped her on the shoulder, and she opened her eyes to see him gesture with a flourish into the sky and say,
Saturn.
The overcast had gone, leaving the night crystal clear and, out here in the boonies, far from any source of artificial light pollution, almost unbelievably starry. They were standing at the top of the castle's tallest tower, surrounded by the low crenellations of the turret roof, so far above the Tsiolkovsky Sea that the sound of the surf was almost lost in the cold but gentle breeze. The scene was flooded with a soft golden light, what Utrina imagined moonlight would look like if it were gold instead of silver. The source of that illumination was plain to see. Hanging in the sky off to the south-southeast, reflected choppily in the still-roughed Tsiolkovsky, was Titan's planet, Saturn. The ringed planet was waning, just past the last quarter. Because Titan was more or less coplanar with him, its rings were nearly invisible from this vantage point, just a thin, bright line dividing the planet in half at a rakish angle, slanting sharply upward from lower left to upper right.
Oh my, said Utna softly, gazing up at it. It was huge, 3 times the size of the moon from Earth or Bajor from Gerardo, so big it almost felt like she could reach up and touch it. Not that she'd want to, because that would disturb its serene, gently striped golden beauty. Earth's moon was beautiful, too, in its way, silver and remote, like a calm, observing presence. And the view of Bajor from Gerardo was inspiring, its soft blue-green light speaking of the life to be found there. Saturn, though, was big and warm and friendly, the golden tint to its light having much the same quality that the yellowish light of a good fire lent to a room like the castle library. Its glow almost seemed to embrace her, as though the ring giant were welcoming her to its backyard and telling her to make herself comfortable.
Remarkable, isn't it? Jury inquired softly. Utna noticed that the redhead's gloved hand was firmly laced with Caitlin's, and grinned at her before turning her attention back skyward again.
Incredible, she remarked. Let's see, there's Orion, Sirius, Aldebaran.
Corwin grinned. No test today, he said, and pointed to a star slightly above and to the right of Saturn. That's Epsilon Eridani, Bahava El, he said.
I thought so, said Utna, nodding with a smile.
She put her arm around his shoulders, gave his hair a ruffle, and went on.
Thank you, Corwin. It's beautiful, just like you said it would be.
He blushed a little, though in the golden light of Saturn it was hard to tell, and replied, You're welcome. I'm actually kind of glad it was snowing when we got in. I think this is the best place in the world to see it from. Then he chuckled and added, Sometime I'll have to take you up to Mimas. There's no atmosphere there, so we'll have to wear the suits again, but it's a lot closer to Saturn. He held out his hands a couple of feet apart. Takes up about this much of the sky.
Wow.
It's something, all right, Nall chipped in as he performed his ritual abandonment of Corwin's shoulder for Utna's. Caitlin was always very impressed to see Saturn, and Jury's reaction to it had been worth braving the cold. It was a rare thing for the redhead's face to show actual wonder, but when she'd opened her eyes and seen the ringed planet, then, just for a moment, it had. Kate froze that sight in her memory with a private little smile, knowing that she would savor it for a long time to come. But right now she was freezing, and so she gave her brother a kiss on the cheek, wished him good night, and went back inside with Jury. Utrina, who wasn't bothered much by cold, Corwin, who was bothered by it even less, and Nall, who didn't mind it at all, stayed out there for a while, sitting on the crenellations, talking about the sky and their future plans to show its wonders to a certain somebody.